I'm Mary Moriarty, the Hennepin County Attorney. We Don't Have to Choose is a long-form conversation about the kinds of things we can do in the criminal legal system to make it effective. And we don't have to choose between reform and changes in relying on data and public safety, because it's actually public safety or using data that will get us to public safety. Today, I'm really excited to have Dr. Robert Kinscherf with us. He is uniquely positioned to talk about these particular issues we're about to talk about because he has a doctorate and a law degree. He is the executive director for the Center of Law, Brain, and Behavior. And so I'm just going to jump right into the conversation. As you know, the legal system declares that a person is an adult when they reach 18. What do we get wrong about that?
I think the basic problem that we get wrong about that is that there's no basis for drawing that bright line at age 18. Maturation is not a magical moment on a particular day when on this side of that day you're a kid and on the side of that other side of the day you're an adult. And we've always had different lines for where we think adulthood has sufficiently matured, you're sufficiently an adult to make certain kinds of decisions. So for purposes of criminal jurisdiction, it's very familiar to draw the line at age 18. In some places, you can sign contracts at age 18 and you get married at age 18. Although you can't buy alcohol or cannabis until you're 21 and you can stay on your parents' insurance until you're 26. And in many jurisdictions, you don't have to be 18 before you can legally consent to sexual activity. And in some states, you can be deemed mature enough to drive an automobile, which if done improperly can be a killing machine. And in some states, they say, yes, but you can drive at 16, but you have to be 17 or 18 before you can drive alone and without a parent or other adult in the car. You can't be driving with your friends, for example, without an adult in the car. So culturally, we've been very ambivalent about where we draw the line of full adult responsibility for what purpose. And so we allow people to risk becoming parents before they are age 18, but they can't buy a beer till they're 21. We will let them drive cars at 16 or so. In some jurisdictions, you can even get practice licenses before age 16.
But insurance companies are going to charge you a lot.
They will charge you a lot for that, and there's good reasons for that. But the law lets us do it. And the insurance companies take premiums to clean up the mess. So at 16, I can potentially kill a bunch of people if I mishandle a car. But I can also be at age 18 in many jurisdictions sentenced to life without possibility of parole or even exposed to the death penalty. So people hang on to age 18. That is mostly due to familiarity and kind of a cultural artifact. But that artifact is one piece of how ambiguously we view the decision-making capacities of adolescents and young adults.
So if you're looking at neuroscience and young people, that artificial age of 18 is simply that. It's artificial. It has no basis in science.
It has no basis in science. And what the science would tell us is that, in fact, process of maturation from puberty through the mid-20s, for example, is a trajectory. It's a familiar trajectory where we see certain kinds of brain functions, certain kinds of behavior being more typical than they will be either as younger children or older adults. We see this process of gradual unfolding of social maturation and brain maturation, but there's no magical moment on the 18th birthday that makes any sense from a science point of view. And even if it did, when you look at the studies, and this is not going to be surprising to anybody, it's not as though all young people are marching in a single formation across a single trajectory towards adulthood. We've all met people where we look at them and say, huh, 16 going on 40. And people where we look at somebody and say, 46 going on 8. And so there's wide variability in the specific roads of that trajectory, although the trajectory itself sort of unfolds sequentially.
So I want to talk about some terminology.
Sure.
When we're talking about adolescence, how is that defined in terms of age in your field?
There's still some disparity in the use of the terms, but ordinarily, and here I'll be talking about, you know, plus or minus a couple of years, depending upon which definition you use. But I think most people would agree that the period of adolescence begins with the onset of puberty, whether you enter puberty at 10 or 14 or 15. Early adolescence is usually thought of as being around 12, 13, 14, middle adolescence, 15, 16, 17. Late adolescence, 18, 19, 20, sometimes 20, and emerging young adult, 20, 21, 22.
So the courts actually, the Supreme Court actually kind of ventured into adolescent brain development and neuroscience years ago. Can you describe what those, some of those decisions, I know there were a series of decisions, what did those decisions say about development and the law?
Prior to 2005, in the decade before 2005, there had been a great deal of constitutional litigation around the death penalty. And the Supreme Court before 2005 had adjusted the age at which a young person could commit a crime and be exposed to the death penalty, for example. When we get to 2005, the Supreme Court is squarely asked the question, at what point is it constitutional to execute somebody? Or, and at the time, the United States was one of only two or three other countries that permit execution under judicial fiat. Most of our peer nations had already abolished the death penalty, and most of them had also made it impossible to sentence a young person to life without possibility of parole. In Roper v. Simmons, the court faced this constitutional question squarely, and they combined two strains of constitutional doctrine. One was the death penalty is different. The other is children are different. And to sum it up, the heart of the argument is something like this. If the death penalty is to be reserved for the punishment of the most heinous crimes committed by the most morally culpable persons, then due to developmental immaturity, a person under the age of 18, a child, could never be that most culpable of persons warranting the death penalty. Children are different, essentially. When they took this step, they were doing something they do very infrequently, but had fairly recently done something like this before Roper v. Simmons. That was in a case called Atkins v. Virginia, where the court decided that it was unconstitutional because of the developmental differences and vulnerabilities of persons with intellectual disability to impose capital punishment on a person with an intellectual disability. And they did so in an interesting way. They basically argued in Atkins v. Virginia and in Roper v. Simmons that because the death penalty is the most severe punishment reserved for the most morally culpable perpetrators of the most heinous crimes, neither the intellectually disabled, and by extension of that argument, persons under the age of 18 could ever fall into that category of most heinous, morally culpable offenders.
So I'm curious about the, we were talking about 18 to 25 or so. I think many people, if they're around kids, they have kids, they understand that under 18, which we've discussed is artificial, they can see differences. And I think that they can also see differences in ages 18 to 25, but somehow that doesn't really or hasn't really hit the law. And I found here when I came to the county attorney's office, even if people here would think of, well, if this person turns 18, then everything's different. Then the penalty should be different than what it would be if they were 17. Can you talk about the maybe the development of that emerging adulthood in the law? Is it really recognized at all?
Slowly but surely. The first steps were really, first I'll do the federal trajectory and then we'll see what's happening in the states. The federal trajectory was really triggered by Roper v. Simmons, and they took children as a class off of the list of those who could be executed. And they did so as a category. There were arguments to be made that we should look at these cases of children who commit murder, for example, on an individual basis and try and assess their maturity. Maybe this child shouldn't be executed because they're manifestly immature, but this one seems more mature, and so they should be subject to the death penalty. But the court made some interesting observations that we'll see in some of the later cases. The first was that when the death penalty is on the table, it is a consequence which, once implemented, can never be undone. So if you have a punishment that you can never undo, even if it later becomes clear you got it entirely wrong, then you have to look at how reliably you can make that determination. And they pointed out that, and this is almost a direct quote, even an experienced psychologist has difficulty looking at a person 16, 17, and reliably predicting what they're going to look like when they're 25, 35, 45. As a science matter, the Supreme Court in Roper could have gone one bridge further and said, it's not possible for anybody, whether you're an experienced psychologist or child psychiatrist or a judge with many years on the bench, to reliably make that prediction. This was important legally because the constitutional doctrine of the death penalty required not only that you have committed a capital offense for which you could be executed, but the court had to make a determination that you were going to continue to be an offender, specifically a violent offender, over the course of your life. It's arguable whether or not we can do that with adults, but it's certainly true that we can't look at somebody in their early adolescence, mid-adolescence, and predict that they will be a persistent, violent life course offender over the course of their life. So one of the mechanisms that they turned to and sort of reasoning this out was something that had never really been available before, and that was the emerging brain science. It had only been maybe 10, 15, 20 years before the Roper decision that we're beginning to see the real development of first the MRI, which allows you to look at the structures of a brain, and then the fMRI, which is a technology where you can look at various parts of the brain activating when the individual is doing certain tasks. And so as the stakes for being punished got higher during the crack and gun epidemic of the 80s and 90s, where incorrect, fortunately incorrect, academics were predicting the rise of the super predator, people began to pay more attention to how good are we actually at understanding the brain development trajectory of adolescents and young adults, the social maturation. Because if you're out of juvenile court, which is intended to be rehabilitative, and in criminal court, while we talk about rehabilitation, quite frankly, compared to our peer nations, that's not really what we're good at or spend most of our dollars on. It's is more punitive approach. So I think the Roper court used the combination of the brain science that was emerging at the time and the maturation science, which was also emerging at the time, to kind of thread the needle between 20 years of arguing about whether you were hard on crime or soft on crime. Because I think what they were doing, and I don't know how mindful they were, but what they ended up doing was creating a third trajectory, which is, are we smart on crime? What are the limits of what we can predict? What are the limits of what we want to be able to say about people and their moral culpability for their offenses? So your question also had to do with, is the law behind the times? I think the answer to that is yes.
Yes.
And it depends on where you are. So briefly, the federal trajectory was Roper v. Simmons, execution off the table. In 2010, Graham v. Florida, life without possibility off the table for non-homicides. 2012, they squarely addressed the issue in Miller v. Alabama about whether or not there should be life without possibility of parole for homicides. And at that point, the composition of the court had changed. Those who had wanted to categorically take life without possibility of parole for homicides committed by persons under the age of 18, they couldn't get a majority for that. The compromise was to take mandatory life without possibility of parole off the table for sentencing persons under the age of 18 who had committed capital crimes, and instead to ask a sentencing judge to make an individualized determination about the maturity of this young person and the relevance of their youth. Ironically, the Miller case in 2012 was asking a sentencing judge to do precisely what the Supreme Court in Roper has said it's not possible to do. Nonetheless, everybody blinked a little bit and said, oh, okay, we'll do individualized sentencing. And the goal was then to ask a sentencing judge to decide whether the crime reflected transient immaturity or reflected that rare case of a youth who was permanently incorrigible.
And that's where we get the Miller factors.
And those are the Miller factors.
Before we get into that, I think about that court decision was a political compromise, I would say. But it is also, it has created tremendous problems, because if we can't, if professionals who understand development can't make that decision, certainly judges and prosecutors and lawyers can't make it. And so that's where I think a lot of the problems have come in, because, and I want to talk to you about the developmental stages and why it's very hard. I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because you've used these terms, there's a difference, as I come from it, as a prosecutor, like public safety and punishment. And if you look at developmental science, what I think we as prosecutors are supposed to be looking at is what is in the best interest of public safety with this young person. And that can often be very different than what someone would talk about in terms of punishment. So punishment is really a kind of a, I don't know if you'd say it's a moral determination. And I've heard this over and over. If young person takes a life, they have crossed a line, and I want to talk to you about that, but then they should be punished. And in many people's minds, punished means many, many years or decades of prison. However, what we also know is that does not keep the public safe, and it is not the way to rehabilitate anyone. And in fact, it may likely make that person less safe in the community, because at least in Minnesota, everybody gets out. Most people get out. So when you think, I want to go back to development and the Miller factor, like what kinds of things do you see in neuroscience about development that's kind of categorical with young people?
So some of the universal phenomena that we see is as a child enters puberty, we begin to see the maturation of the human brain going from back to front. That's why some children may look physically much older than they appear to be emotionally and intellectually, but back to front. And so you have this process by which physical maturation begins to proceed other forms of maturation as other parts of the brain develop and realign with each other. The midbrain is the part of the brain that develops next. It becomes hypersensitized, if you will, hyperactive, if you will, during the transition of adolescence. And those are systems of the brain that are responsible for reward sensitivity, threat detection, and emotion. And probably all of us can remember the highs and lows of being early to mid-adolescence. I mean, the end of your first crush was devastating in the rest of your life. The euphoria that you felt when you finally heard the perfect song and would find yourself singing it many times a day or even sharing it with your friends. Taylor Swift phenomenon is an excellent example of sort of group euphoria. And look at the demographics of who her most strident fans are. The last part of the brain to come online is the cortex and prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that allows us to inhibit impulses, identify options, consider consequences, the kinds of things that make us rational beings, if you will, rational decision makers. There is a period of time where normally, you know, in normal development, we're not even talking about young people who've been exposed to trauma and poverty and all these other things, where the sort of energetic activity of the midbrain is poorly regulated by the still developing frontal lobe. Or as a neuroscience friend of mine, she's a bench neuroscientist, and I love talking to her because when she starts talking about real serious neuroscience, she always slows down and talks to me in the way that an adult talks to a much younger child while trying to explain something complicated. So she was trying to describe this kind of poor fit between the activity of the amygdala and the still developing frontal lobe. And finally she said, let me make it simple, Robert. It's like an adolescent, a normal adolescent has phases in their development, early to mid-adolescence especially, when it's like having the mighty engine of a Ferrari controlled by the brakes of a Honda Fit. This is part of the normal brain development that we see in things like their increased vulnerability to impulsivity, to the immediacy of rewards or threats, sensation seeking, stimulation seeking, novelty seeking, a certain kind of recklessness. And this vulnerability, especially in conditions where they are also emotionally activated or psychologically aroused, physically aroused, this vulnerability remains in late adolescence and early young adulthood until the late teens and early 20s. So that is a process that we see in every culture across nations. This is sort of the way of the human brain, if you will, in its gradual unfolding in the second great phase of brain development in human life, the first one being fetal development in early infancy.
Sometimes I hear people talk about a youth who's committed a crime and say, well, he knew right from wrong. You should know right from wrong, or my kid would know right from wrong. My kid would never do that. And one of the things, well, I've heard it described as, yes, young people do know right from wrong. They do know that something a lot of the time isn't a good idea, but because of impulse control, all of those kinds of things, they simply, especially if they're in a moment of high stress, can't override that impulse control. So they might know, I shouldn't be doing this. And if they were in a calm setting without that stress, without the other factors, they wouldn't do it necessarily, but that gets overridden.
So let me make two observations. First observation is that with mid-adolescence, you see spikes in all kinds of risk behavior. They not only commit more crimes, they're also in more car crashes, even after you control for the practice effect. They drown more often. They have more unintended pregnancies. They're more likely to develop patterns of substance misuse. They're more likely to engage in self-injury or attempt suicide. They engage in a variety of health risk behaviors that if you were to ask them a simple question like, do you think you'll be healthier or less healthy if you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day? Are you more or less likely to have an unintended pregnancy or have a sexually transmitted disease if you have unprotected sex? Are you more or less likely to run into problems with your life if you are using a lot of marijuana or alcohol or other drugs? You can ask them dozens of these health risk-related behaviors. And by the time they're 15, 16, they can give you the right answer. But they're also the demographic which are most likely to actually engage in these health risk behaviors. And people who know about this disconnect, and this is a normal youth, this disconnect between what they know and what they actually do, understand that knowing something intellectually is not the same as appreciating the risks that you're taking upon yourself by engaging in exactly those behaviors. That's why alcohol and tobacco companies, for example, have known for years that you want to get young people smoking and drinking before they're about 18, 19, or 20, because the odds of somebody becoming a pack-a-day smoker or a serious drinker, if they have not developed a history of smoking or drinking before they're 25, just goes down with every single age.
Right.
The likelihood of them getting a sexually transmitted disease or developing an addiction go down with every, you know, with every advancing age as you move through your 20s. So there is this disconnect between what I know in my head and what I actually do. So, and that's not just for crimes. I ask anybody who may be participating in this podcast as a listener to sit down and think for themselves, did you ever do anything that on some level you knew was not a good idea, but you did it anyway between the ages of 13 and 25? Most people, if they're honest with themselves, will say yes.
And that's actually positive.
Yes,
that is a natural, normal part of development.
It is part of what allows them to explore new things. It reflects curiosity. And it can be expressed in many, many different ways. What counts as a risky behavior in one culture may not be the same as a risky behavior in another culture. So it's culturally shaped, but the underlying mechanism is still the same. And an interesting thing happens. Well, the other example I wanted to give, it was to illustrate the importance of context. So a good example of the importance of context, because on some level it's hilarious, is every spring you have students, many of whom are at elite colleges or on dean's lists, who fly to Florida and engage in stupid, reckless behavior. They get intoxicated. They get pregnant. They contract sexually transmitted diseases. They get into fights. We call it spring break. And they will do, many of them engage in high-risk behaviors that they know are high-risk behaviors. Most of them survive, thankfully. Very few of the incidents involve weapons, thankfully. But then they all go back home, and they're still on dean's list in May. Context matters. Now, you take that same group of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are at spring break. We as a culture tolerate spring break. Many cultures tolerate wild behavior under some constrained circumstances to feel their oats, as my grandmother would have put it. Take those same kids. They're not in college. They're not going to go back to a stable environment which requires high demand performance on their part. Instead, they're also drinking too much, a little bit high, maybe a lot high, hanging around with their friends, and they're roaming around their neighborhood when they suddenly encounter another group of adolescents and young adults who they believe shouldn't be there and on their territory, and one or more of them are armed in both groups. That's a very different day, very different possible outcomes, much more potentially lethal. And likely to draw the attention of the law. I have to believe that the Fort Lauderdale police are fairly tolerant of some of the hijinks that they see every spring, quite predictably. That being said, a lot of those kids who we think of as being the risky kids for crime, especially violent crime, when you sit down and talk to them, they don't see themselves as doing this forever. just like most college students don't think they're going to go to Fort Lauderdale every spring for the rest of their lives. They see it as context-bound and time-bound. Many of the young people that are in detention facilities, for example, will tell you, and they are not yanking your chain, that someday they intend to finish high school. Many of them would like to go to college. Many of them, especially in that transitional age, are still running the streets, but they're working at jobs, often not great jobs, but they're working at jobs because they need to earn what they can to help keep their family in housing and food. So context matters, and it can be very, very, very complicated.
So what's the difference in context or demographics between the spring break Fort Lauderdale young people and the kids you've described engaging, like roaming the street, engaging in normal behavior, but maybe criminal behavior?
Well, I think, quite frankly, not everybody is equally privileged. And if I am a freshman or sophomore and I'm in a good college and I have parents who expect that I'm going to be on dean's list, and I like being in college and I like my friends at college, and I think someday I want to be a fill in the blank, a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, it doesn't really matter. I have something to lose by going too far too fast. Some of them do anyway, usually not involving a weapon or a crime, but some of them become pregnant much sooner than they would hope, and that can complicate your college career. But they have something to lose, and they are in a context ordinarily that would frown upon some of the more extreme forms of criminal behavior. A lot of criminal behavior is a function of attitudes, values, and beliefs, plus the context that you're in. The kids who are running the street, many of them don't feel as though they have as much to lose. Many of them want to have successful lives. Many of them will even tell you they want to go to college. But what realistically they look at are laborer or non-skilled worker, lower-paying jobs in difficult economic circumstances.
So coming from poverty.
Coming from poverty. And also subjected, by the way, to many of the other social determinants. I think it's fascinating, Mary, that if you look at the social determinants of your physical health, including how long you're going to live, your behavioral health, including the likelihood that you will develop an anxiety disorder, a depressive disorder, even a psychotic disorder, whether you get involved in the criminal legal system at all, and if you do get involved in the criminal legal system, the likelihood that you will end up in the criminal legal system for a violent crime, there's roughly 12 social determinants of health and well-being broadly that account for a lot of the variance. These are not wildly surprising to hear what they may be. You're going to do less well, for example, if you attend an underachieving school or do not have a consistent positive engagement with school. If you don't have access to adequate medical and behavioral health care, you don't have access to safe and positive recreational activities, you don't have a family that is stable and have the ability to consistently be with you. Many of the young people that I have dealt with have parents who are themselves suffering from mental illness or addiction, or they're not there, not because they don't love their children, but because they have to work two or even three service industry jobs in order to keep housing and food. And so they are literally physically not present, but it's not out of lack of caring or lack of love. Nonetheless, they're not there. So I'll give a quick example of how this context may matter. My son, and I'll probably hear about this for the rest of my life if he listens to your podcast, was a pretty challenging young man to raise. He could be quite impulsive, inattentive. School was not his jam, although he did well enough because we set expectations for him. I was in the position of being able to afford him activities that he really highly valued. and provided him with adult support and supervision and feedback from someone other than myself and his mother. So as he entered adolescence, he was physically very active. The views of him by his friends were incredibly important to him. He craved sort of the attention and social status amongst his peer group. I was in a position of being able to afford to have him try out for, and thankfully he got on, a travel soccer team that played at a very high level. He entered that soccer team when he was 13 years old. That soccer team really became the heart of his adolescent experience. He also played on his high school team. And so he was supervised after school. He had high demands on him by his coaches, who made it very clear they were not from the United States. They were from the United Kingdom. They didn't do adolescents. They did young adults, but they didn't do adolescents. And if you talked back, if you yelled at an opposing team member, God help you, if you ever made a snarky remark to a referee, you wouldn't play. And they practiced a lot. He was constantly exhausted because of the physical labor involved with that. They made it very clear that if he was academically struggling, that he may have to leave the team because that would be important first. That their first job was to teach soccer. Their second job was to teach character. But if you weren't prepared to show up with character, you weren't going to play soccer. Now, take that same... Oh, and he played goalkeeper, which I've come to understand is a sure sign that somebody is crazy. Because
they get balls kicked at their head. It's...
No protective. My son sustained three severe concussions. Right. After the third one, the neurologist said, you can't play soccer anymore because you need to save your last concussion for a skiing accident or a car accident or falling off a ladder. So yes, it's a very high risk, high impact, quite literally position. Now you take my same kid, high reward seeking, very influenced by the perceptions of his peers, reckless and impulsive, risk taking, all that sort of stuff. And you make him a kid who lives in a dangerous neighborhood. Me and his mother both have to work two or sometimes three service industry jobs, so we're out of the house a lot. We have no family who live close by to take over a caretaking role. And all of a sudden he discovers when he's 13, instead of he's going to be a great soccer goalkeeper, that he can make a little money on the side and earn the respect of his peers by being an entry-level drug mule. I don't even get to know about it. And then when he's 16, he is in the business enough that he and his friends, as often happens amongst some of the kids on the street, they have kind of a group gun where everybody knows where it is, and if you need it, you just go get it. And I'm not home, and neither is his mother at 11 o'clock at night because we're both working. Where is he? What is he doing? He's still the same stimulation-seeking, sometimes impulsive, sometimes reckless kid. Same kid, same brain. Just like the college student, dean's list at an elite university, until he's running around naked with his 16 bestest friends ever, intoxicated in Fort Lauderdale. So doesn't mean that either one of them are bad kids, but it does mean that they had different life contexts and life circumstances and were going to be in different kinds of risk environments. The likelihood that somebody would get shot on his soccer team, very low. In some of the neighborhoods where the kids live that I have worked with and gotten to know, sometimes now kids that I did their transfer hearings when they were 15, after they'd been involved in a homicide, I've seen now for their parole hearings when they're 15. You can guess at my age now. I'm a geezer. All of this just to say that it doesn't necessarily make them bad human beings or evil or beyond redemption. It does mean that they live in different risk environments and had to learn how to manage them. With a developing brain, it's kind of like having to ride your bicycle while you're still learning how to ride bicycles. The difference is my son got to drive up and ride up his bicycle up and down a suburban street. Another kid has to ride up and down streets that may be quite dangerous.
Yeah, so I wanted to break that down a little bit. Your son was engaging, he was developing the same way the other boy would be, or the other circumstance where you didn't have maybe the privilege of offering that your son all the things that you were able to offer your son and the soccer team. And you talked about peers and how important. And on the soccer field, that was about, you know, especially as a goalkeeper, you know when you're letting your teammates down because somebody scored. And the coaches gave him incentives or disincentives. I mean, you got to be there. You got to do all these things. So he was engaging in that developmental behavior under circumstances that were pro-social, I guess we would call it, whereas the other boy just didn't have those opportunities. And I think it's really important what you said there, but to emphasize again, they're both engaging in the same developmental process. Neither boy is bad. The boy who's selling drugs, there's nothing wrong with him, but it's just the context of the circumstances.
Right. He's engaging in developmentally expectable risk-taking, exploration, peer influence, all that sort of stuff. It's just the world that he's navigating has a different profile of risks and benefits for him. Now, the good news for us is that most young people who engage in misconduct, even those who have been in mid-adolescence, pretty chronically delinquent, even violently delinquent, if we can keep them from catastrophe, which I often thought was my job as my son's father, was basically to keep him from catastrophe, and it would work itself out, you know, if we could keep him alive long enough. Most young people, even the seriously delinquent ones, as I was mentioning, as brain maturation intersects with social maturation, meaning having to move out of the adolescent role into more adult roles intersect, you see this remarkable self-desistance from crime, including violent crime, right around 22, 23, 24. And that's partly because adolescent behavior becomes inconsistent with developing the kind of life that you, criminal adolescent behavior, becomes inconsistent with developing the kind of life that you've always told yourself you really wanted. Very few 14-year-olds really sort of think of joining a gang as being a career choice that's going to take them into their 70s. And this phenomenon of social maturation, or this age crime curve, has been described since the 1830s. This is not exactly a national security secret. It has been repeated over and over again in the United States, in our peer countries, even in developing countries. You see this spike of all kinds of risky behaviors, like I was saying, driving, smoking, drinking, unprotected sex, all this sort of stuff. And then it starts to come down without being sanctioned officially by being incarcerated by the state or whatever. So only about 5% of young people who come into contact with the juvenile system will penetrate into the adult criminal justice system and become life course career criminals. One of the challenges of getting this right is that if you were going to design a system where you wanted to lengthen the careers, criminal careers of people, or even put them into that 5% who will continue to be criminals over the course of their life, one of the important strategies that you would want to put in place almost immediately is to take them as young as possible, remove them from their communities, and put them into closed environments that is populated with other criminals, many of them much older than them.
Like the juvenile detention center. Something like that.
Well, or even worse, incarceration in prisons. And as young persons who go into incarceration settings, I mean, let's just be honest about this. The data is very clear. If you are a young person going into an adult incarceration setting, you're much more likely to be sexually assaulted, physically assaulted, by both staff and fellow inmates. You'll be pressed into gang involvement in order to survive. You have to create a reputation that you are not to be messed with. Our incarceration settings are not very good at education, although we know that educating a person is probably the best crime prevention tool you could use. If you look at inmates who have received college degrees in while incarcerated and subsequently released, their incarceration rate, their rearrest rates are under 3%. So we can either spend on the low end $30,000 or $40,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. At least in my state, the high end is well over $100,000 a year for the maximum security facility. Or we can say, maybe we don't want as one of our core policies taking young people who have committed crimes, especially the ones who are going to come back.
Which is most of them.
Which is most of them. In most of the states, most of them will come back. And they'll come back as relatively young persons in their late 20s, early 30s, typically. Maybe we don't want to do the one thing that we know increases the likelihood of recidivism risk, because recidivism is a direct affront to community safety.
Mm-hmm.
We may want to say, okay, we have tried the mass incarceration and punitive model, in which really the only tool for accountability we have thought is incarceration, deprivation of liberty, and instead think of a more restorative model where we actually harness this age crime curve and equip them to be successful young adults. And if they are successful as young adults, the odds that they would return to a life of crime in their 30s, 40s, and 50s is very low.
So going back to Miller, rather than going with a categorical approach, it seems that the Supreme Court put judges and all of us in a no-win, and young people, in a no-win situation here, because they've told judges to try to look at a young person and decide, you know, is this that one young person who is incorrigible, that kind of thing. Well, that's impossible. And I'm wondering if you think, is this... And I know it's probably intuitive for people to assume that the more serious the crime or the more serious the background, that there's really no hope for, that's the person who's committed a murder or something like that, that they're incorrigible. When we know that isn't true, but I think people think that. And do you think it's a kind of a result of Miller and forcing judges to make these decisions, which are impossible, that they tend to rely on, and most do? Oh, it's a serious crime, therefore.
I think that's a very good point. It's a complicated point. And it's complicated in a couple of ways. The first is, Miller directed a sentencing judge to look at what the Miller opinion called the hallmark features of adolescence: impetuosity, recklessness, a few failure to appreciate consequences, all that sort of stuff, which we know is rooted in a combination of brain and social development. It asked them to look at family instability, family circumstances. If children do not have parents who are invested in them, but also capable of structuring them, guiding them, watching them, and they do not have another consistent adult to do that for them, then they're trying to have to figure out a complicated world all by themselves. A third was, what was the actual participation of the young person in the crime? When Massachusetts, which had mandatory life without possibility of parole, looked at the young people that were now going to have to be eligible for parole at some point after Miller, we discovered that for most of the young people, over 50%, their arraignment on murder was the first time they'd ever been arrested in court. And that most of them were there not because they had pulled a trigger or stabbed the knife.
Mm-hmm.
They were there on felony murder or other kind of transferred intent,
right,
shared intent, theories of prosecution. The court also directed them to directed judges to think about the possible legal incompetencies that are affiliated or associated with youthfulness. That starts with your behavior at the time of your arrest, runs through Miranda. Do you understand your Miranda? Did your parents, if they were there to guide you, do they understand Miranda? Did they understand the role of their attorney? Do they understand the role of the other legal actors? And there's good research to suggest that many young people, even kids who've been in court before, have significant misunderstandings about what their rights and responsibilities are in front of court. We know that their plea bargain decision-making is often flawed, and their loyalties, often peer loyalties, are misplaced. And finally, the courts were supposed to look at a youth's greater possibilities for rehabilitation. And when it's done properly, when you have a restorative rather than retributive model, your outcomes are so much better. So our peer countries rely more heavily upon a restorative model. In some European countries, for example, even if you've committed a serious crime, they have a tripartite system, which they actually borrowed from the U.S., although we never did it here. Juvenile court to 18, young adult court 18 to 26, catching that age crime curve, where they rely very heavily on education, literacy, pre-vocational, with the understanding that most of them will be out. We sentence people for decades. They sentence people for years. You don't even get to go to prison with persons over 26 until you're over 26 yourself, right? So they have harnessed this age crime curve in a way that, that we have not. So if you were just going to say, I love community safety, and you appreciate that most young people who are incarcerated will be coming out, you would want those who don't need to be incarcerated not to be incarcerated. Those who may need incarceration, not for punishment so much as to basically hold them still, incapacitate them for a while so that you can, till they age out, but also you can do interventions that range from treating unmet mental health needs to challenging criminogenic attitudes, values, and beliefs, giving them a job skill so they don't have to go back out to a rotten job and think that's what they are for the rest of their life. That's where the recidivism rates of our peer countries is remarkably lower for youthful offenders than our rates are. If you were to just look at it and say, this isn't working and it's really expensive, and over the long haul, it reduces public safety, it doesn't enhance public safety. Or another way to put it more simply, if treating young people as punitively as possible was going to work for either deterring that individual again or deterring other young people from behaving badly, you would expect that the American systems that rely most heavily on aggressive and punitive approaches with incarceration as the tool of accountability would have the lowest offense and recidivism rates. They have the highest.
And that goes back to impulsiveness and inability at that age to override that impulsiveness or peer pressure, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In terms of deterrence.
So you had asked a moment ago about the significance of the heinousness of a crime, a very severe crime like participation or directly committing a murder. And intuitively, I can see how people get there. It just turns out that there's really no predictive value for ultimate rehabilitation of the heinousness of the crime per se. So there's a remarkable study that I think people should be aware of. It's called the Philadelphia Experience. It was authored by Tarika Daftouri Kapoor, who is at Montclair State University. She and her colleague took advantage of the post-Miller release or parole eligibility of about 300 young people who had been sentenced to life without possibility of parole prior to Miller and were serving life sentences for their involvement in homicides committed as juveniles. I think she ultimately enrolled about 200 of them in her longer-term study. When I ask people what they think the recidivism rate many years out, several years out now, was of cohort of juveniles who were sentenced to life without possibility of parole, some will say 30%, some will say 40%, some will say 50%, some will say more than 50%, 60%. At her follow-up period, which was some years out, the recidivism rate or the reoffense rate was 3%, which out of her number was six people. Of those six folks, none of them were arrested on a major crime of violence. There was only one crime against a person. It was a felony, but it was a purse snatching. The rest, one other went back, I think, on a technical violation of probation, and the other ones, the cases were ultimately dismissed. They were not sent back to prison. I think when people think this is so heinous, a young person has committed a murder, they have to be beyond redemption. They have crossed a line, and they can never come back. Well, the data would suggest that even in the prison environment, as they socially mature, because these were individuals who were all at or about 40 years of age at the time that they were released. So well after the age crime curve, some of them went in and had turbulent institutional adjustment, but at around 25, 26, 27, they chilled out. And they're in the community. They're in the community safely. We wouldn't expect that if heinousness were kind of a permanent blood stain, which now separates you forever from the rest of us. And I think that's worth noting. Now, in all fairness, I have had some people who have been victimized by a murder committed by a juvenile. And I just want to comment that the victim community is a very heterogeneous community. The victim community is not united in a single voice that these are young people who need to go away forever. It's actually many of them are involved in restorative justice practices inside the prisons, assist with reentry. I've been at parole hearings where members of the murder victim's family came and testified in favor of the parole of the young person, or the person who's now an older person, who was a young person at the time. So they're a heterogeneous community, but I at least like the intellectual honesty of a man who came up to me after a conversation similar to this one and said, you know, I lost my son to gun violence when he was 16 years old, and the person who shot my son has been in prison for many years now. And doctor, frankly, I don't care if he's Mahatma Gandhi when he's 40. He needs to die in prison. And I hope he doesn't get demented, because I want him to know where he is and why he's dying in prison on the day he takes his last breath. Okay. If the only rationale, whether it makes sense for public safety or not, whether expensive and unnecessary or not, is pure punishment, then that kind of makes it a much less complicated proposition. But if we do think... and many people are in religious traditions who believe there is such a thing as redemption, then if we do think people are redeemable, then we might want to invest in the redemption rather than the punishment. Prisons need not have the miserable conditions of confinement that many American prisons have. Our peer countries don't have prisons that have these miserable and dehumanizing conditions. And if you keep people long enough, you would expect that at least some people who come from those conditions will remain miserable and dehumanized, which is not a good way to bring them back into the community.
If I could circle back to the man whose son had been murdered, I've certainly talked to loved ones who've had that happen, and certainly they don't have the same idea of what should happen. They're all across the board. And what he wanted was certainly legitimate. He, you know, has every right to express that. And I think you're right in that if we're going to be intellectually honest here, we have to say, if we are about rehabilitation, especially in juvenile court, if we are about public safety, then we need to approach this in a different way. But if we want to talk about punishment, then let's make sure we're talking about punishment. And for some people, that's how we should be, the route we should be going. But we shouldn't say to ourselves, we're talking about public safety, because they are two different things.
So they are two very, very different things. And I think many people in the community of people who have lost friends and loved ones to violence, that's part of the discussion that you hear amongst them as well. I did just want to say one final thing about the Miller factors, which was you pointed out that it puts judges in a terrible predicament because, quite frankly, I think Roper got it right. We can't do it yet now after Miller judges are intended to do it. In a subsequent case in the newly constituted, more recent Supreme Court, the Supreme Court clarified that judges didn't actually have to make specific written opinions applying the Miller factors. All they had to do was allude to, well, I took into consideration the youthfulness of the defendant at the time of sentencing. And that has, from a federal point of view, you know, defanged Miller and rendered it meaningless. That being said, states are continuing to move forward with this more restorative rather than retributive model. In Massachusetts, for example, our Supreme Court in 2024, in a case called Commonwealth v. Mattis, took life without possibility of parole off the table for persons 18, 19, and 20. The Washington State Supreme Court did so in a case called Monsky, although they're revisiting it now with the change of the composition of their Supreme Court. Michigan recently took life without possibility of parole off the table for 18-year-olds. So either through court action or legislative action, it's slowly beginning to sort of permeate the political consciousness and the legal community. And I find it worth remembering that during the first Trump administration, the only major piece of bipartisan legislation that the U.S. Congress managed to pass was an omnibus criminal justice reform bill, because the progressive faction and the conservative faction could agree on two things: that we have the highest recidivism rate amongst our peer countries, and it's an endless money pit that's immensely expensive and getting more expensive. So if it's not working, we're paying a whole lot of money for it. Whether you're conservative or a progressive, it's just not working. And the fact that we have such an astonishingly high recidivism rate tells you that it's compromising public safety as compared to the lower recidivism rates in our peer countries. So if it's expensive, not working, and actually over time making our communities less safe, what is compelling us to hold on to this is a really interesting question.
And I think a lot of that is public narrative. It's fear. It's assumptions. It's talk about super predators. It's the belief that the heinous crime, the person who commits the heinous crime needs to go for a long period of time. Also, I hear deterrence. I heard that in a conversation I was having today where somebody said to me, well, it's all about deterrence. And I said, we're talking about young people, and because of all these factors, that is not a deterrent, but people think it is. So I think there's a lot of misinformation out there.
And I think that's one of the shibboleths that is a great contributor to, you know, keeping us where we are without much movement. There's not evidence for the proposition that harsh punishments for young people deters young people. As I mentioned before, if that were true, you would expect the states that have the harshest punishments to have the lowest crime rates. But it's exactly the opposite.
It also doesn't make any sense. If you're thinking, if we know a young person knows right from wrong, knows perhaps that they shouldn't be doing something, but that's overridden by peer pressure, you know, sensation seeking, that kind of thing, it does not then stand to think that they're thinking, well, if I do this thing, then I could, this could be the consequence. I could go to prison. It just, that's not the thought process.
That is not the thought process. In fact, the research is pretty clear that it's not the severity of punishment that has a deterrent effect. It is the perception of a high likelihood of a consequence in a consistently applied consequence. The consequence does not have to be incarceration.
Right.
It can be incarceration, but not for decades. And then that raises the question of, if we want to lower the recidivism risk of persons who are incarcerated, what are our conditions of confinement and what are we doing with people while they're there, other than putting them into gang-operated, drug-infested environments with very little to do?
So I listened to a presentation where the presenter was talking about two different ways you could look at young people. You could look at the behavior, which I think goes to the heinous crime, the that kind of thing, or you could look at the development and think about it being normal development, and then how do we address the development, or not address it. The other thing that she said in this presentation was interesting to me, that she was talking about toddlers, and everybody celebrates these milestones, first step, first this, first that. And what we've been talking about in adolescence is natural, normal development that people, young people, have to go through to get to be an adult. But people don't celebrate that way. And it was like fear of, yeah.
Well, I think that makes a good point. A way of thinking about it that I find helpful is it's normal development with behavior gone awry. And sometimes behavior goes awry because some of the developmental processes are inadequately supported or have gone awry. So if you want to resolve the behavior that has gone awry, your best bet is to look at what is going wrong in development and how do we get this young person back on a positive youth and young adult development track, because for the most part, they are going to be in our communities for big chunks of their lives, even if we do incarcerate them for some periods.
So what should that look like?
I think at the individual level, one of the most important positive developmental assets for any young person is a positive, consistent adult who will stick with them through thick and thin and coach them through the challenges of adolescence and early young adulthood in a firm but consistent way. The Search Institute, just before the pandemic, did a study, which I find alarming, which is 40% of young people will tell you, 40%, that they don't have a person like that in their lives.
40.
They do not have a consistent, caring adult who can guide them through the thicket of adolescence and early young adulthood. So at the individual level, getting them in relationships with adults who care about them, who will stick with them, who want them to move on with their lives, but they pass them on to other adults who will care about them and so forth. At a mega view, a high policy level, addressing the social determinants that put people on the developmental tracks towards poorer health and earlier death, poorer behavioral health outcomes, more mental illness, more psychiatric impairment, criminal justice involvement, and violent crime that leads to deep-end criminal justice involvement. Those social determinants are things that we can pay attention to in broad-scale public policy.
And much of that comes from systemic racism.
Some of it comes from systemic racism. Much of it does. I referred earlier to our peer nations sort of copying our idea about this tripartite system. that idea of a juvenile court, then a young adult court, and then an adult court was devised in the 1940s. It was part of model legislation before the U.S. Congress, but it never got through. The opposition to that reform was mostly from the southern states, not all of it, mostly from the southern states where Jim Crow and the criminal justice system were hand in glove, and they were not looking to lighten the load of the criminal justice system, because criminal justice system was intentionally designed to keep people disenfranchised. And oh, by the way, once you had been convicted of a felony, you never got to vote again.
Right.
So that was not going to happen. But so systemic racism was kind of baked into the current system that we have, although many people are unaware of its historical origins in that way, or the reluctance to reform, because by the mid-20th century, people knew this was not working the way we had hoped. The model that you do something bad, we punish you, you stop behaving badly, we knew that wasn't working by the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which is why we actually had a fairly low rate of incarceration nationally until we got to the 1970s, 80s, and 90s.
So I think some people listening to this tend to think of Jim Crow, that kind of thing, as something that happened in the South. And I think it's good to remind people that in Minnesota, we have among the highest racial disparities in the country on pretty much every social determinant that you mentioned.
And, you know, Massachusetts is often thought of as sort of the People's Republic of Massachusetts, the you know, socialist pearl in the Northeast. But we also have very clear data of systemic racism in all manner of our policies and systems as well. I think it's good news that people can actively talk about it, even in our legislature, in a way that is not possible in other places, but it's a thing. And I was born and raised in Texas, so I get to say that.
Oh, okay. So this has been a wonderful conversation, and I want to thank you for joining us here. And actually, thank you. You're here in town to do some training for our staff and have conversations with stakeholders in the community. And I think it's a wonderful thing for people here to be listening and discovering what neuroscience tells us about young people and what actually works with them. So thank you so much.
I thank you for the opportunity, and I had the opportunity to look at some of your policy and strategic documents, and I'm very confident that if you are able to implement your very robust vision for how to kind of turn the angle, you know, change the narrative and move towards a restorative rather than retributive system, that people will come to recognize that you have actually found a way to increase public safety for all the people of Minnesota.
Thank you. So that's our podcast for today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a high rating and please join us for our next podcast. Thank you.